everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Have you all managed to get yourself a glass of something refreshing? We've got plenty of wine and juices and things, as well as cheese and biscuits, so do help yourselves. So we're really delighted to be welcoming you to Birkbeck, which is the home of the Open Library of Humanity. So this is a large publishing platform that I have set up with my colleague Martin Eve. I should introduce myself, I'm Caroline Benjamins. So Martin and I are based here in the Department of English and Humanities, and in 2013 we launched a new kind of open access publisher. So the idea was that we want to try and break away from many of the economic problems associated with paying for very expensive journal subscriptions. And so we wanted a kind of academic-led, community-organised publishing platform of our own that we could be in charge of, that is not for profit, that is actually now a charity under UK law. So we launched the platform in the end of September 2015. Originally we launched with, I think, 11 journals, and now we have just over 18 journals. One of which is the Journal of Embodied Research, which is why you're here tonight. So we're really pleased to be launching the Journal of Embodied Research with the editorial team tonight, particularly because it sort of embodies the new digital possibilities of publishing online. So we're doing quite a lot of computer programming and tech work on our platform and on the publishing front. So it's fantastic to be able to showcase a journal that really takes advantage of those digital opportunities that wouldn't actually be possible in a print format and would look very different in a print format. As someone who has a side interest in film and media studies, it's always really struck me how kind of insane it is that the people working in those disciplines have to, maybe if you're lucky you get permission for a screen grab that's maybe a bit blurry, and then you have to sort of describe what happens in a scene. And so doing kind of close text analysis of anything that requires video content is very difficult in print. So we're very delighted with this one, and of course this journal is incredibly interdisciplinary. It covers all kinds of areas from film and TV and media, right through to theatre and performance, and also of course sports sciences, physiology, and arts practice, and therapy, and so on. So it's a great way to bring together these digital publishing opportunities with a very interdisciplinary kind of scholarly journal. And interdisciplinarity is something that we're really keen on at the Open Library of Humanities, because we are a broad kind of church of humanities journals. So I think for this evening we're going to have some short presentations from some of the editors-in-chief who are here with us tonight. I think first of all, Martin, did you want to say a quick thing about your lecture, or do you want to sum up later?
Yeah, I'll just say, hi, I'm Martin, I'm the other half of the famous actor. Yeah, it's great. What I want to say was, it's very easy when you propose new platforms for publishing to think, yeah, we'll do that. We'll put a load of our energy in saying that it's volunteerist, and then we'll burn ourselves out in 3 years' time and we'll be dead and we'll have to go back to teaching and it's not going to work. So it was very important as we started that we came up with an economic model that could support us in the long term. So we now have 220 libraries around the world that are paying year on year into the Open Library of Humanities. That includes Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cambridge, big names, universities, but right down to small theological colleges in the States. And what I wanted to stress was that this is designed to look like a subscription, but we make the work available so anyone can read it. So we get both the benefits of open access and the benefits of the subscription model without the disadvantages of either, that I'm sure many of us are familiar with in other cases. But this is also my cheeky plea. If you're at an institution and your institution does not yet support the Open Library of Humanities, please do consider asking your librarian. We're very cheap. We are half the price of a single article at Taylor & Francis per year on an open access basis. And we can do a lot more with that work on a charitable basis than an organisation that makes 38% profit can. So if you support what we're doing and you want this journal to thrive, please do consider going to libraries. That's all I'm going to do on the sales pitch front, but thank you very much for coming as well. I'm going to hand back to Caroline.
So I'm going to hand now to Dr. Ben Spatz from University of Huddersfield to tell us a bit more about the journal. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm extremely honored to be here and to be speaking to you about this new journal. I want to say first thank you to the two of you and for making this incredible adventure, the Open Library of Humanities. As I was developing the idea for this journal and going through these certain steps of thinking, well, it has to be video articles specifically, and it obviously has to be open access, and here's the kind of structure we should have. And then I started to shop it around a little bit, and the economics just were impossible in the places that I looked, and it led me to think, well, there's a really substantive question here, which is, what funding model could work? Who should be funding the open access journals of the future now that there's a huge movement towards open access publishing for scholars, for researchers? There's a huge huge motivation to shift and to flip journals. How can this be solved? I have no idea. This is not my field. I don't know. And then suddenly I discovered that some people had come up with a brilliant alternative funding model that uses the resources that exist, that creates a constituency of libraries to fund this kind of work, and I think that's just extraordinary. So I was very honored and pleased to go through that process and have the journal approved. Let me say a few words, I won't speak very long, I had a few thoughts to share about the journal. There's so much to say, and in a way, my thoughts about the journal are already contained in the submission guidelines, which usually submission guidelines are not so substantive, they're kind of the same for most journals, but this is one of the sets of submission guidelines where it was like a lot of thinking and sweating over how will this be submitted, and it was shared with the editorial advisory board, which is a very illustrious, wonderful group of people, and gave feedback to it. So there's a lot of thought in the submission guidelines. It remains speculative, in the sense that it's the best that we collectively could put forward in terms of what we think should be governing guidelines, but there's quite an open field here. But let me point to some hidden histories of the relationship between video and embodiment. I put this video up, which I've been using this collage for many years, to point towards the field of embodied practice, and specifically embodied research, because not only are we seeing here four very different embodied practices, but we're also seeing something close to the origin point of four areas of embodied practice, four areas of embodied knowledge, which are still taught today by many, many people who are not the practitioners who are pictured in the videos. So you can see here not just really interesting practices, but research moments, moments of research where knowledge was generated about possibilities, things that you can do with your body, with bodies, which then has gone around and circulated and had much, much wider effect than probably could have been imagined by the individuals who are pictured here. So that, I think, is very important in thinking about these fields of embodied practice as ongoing, as continuous, as continually branching and developing and changing. In terms of, I was going to mention these three points of appearance of embodied knowledge circulating through video. Maybe this is already enough, but I'll tell you what they were. In the founding document of Marcel Mauss on embodied technique, he talks about how ways of walking moved from the US over to Europe through film. And those aren't anthropological documents of how people walked. They're just movies, regular movies, which intended to be about plot and character and whatever else. But encoded in them, somehow, was ways of walking. And he noticed that was being transmitted. So that's like a secret history. I was at the Tate this afternoon, and I saw this installation about performance art, and it was referring to the famous film of Jackson Pollock making his paintings, where, again, the thing that was important there at the time, that was the thing that would have been the ostensible focus, was the painting itself, the art object, the item that then emerges and then is sold for thousands of dollars. But in fact, the video had a huge impact because it was about the embodied practice that was leading to that painting, and it helped displace the location of meaning off just the physical object of the painting itself and onto the embodied practice and the embodied knowledge that was creating that. And then this morning in The Guardian, I don't remember what article it was, there was something that was talking about YouTube and vlogging, which is such a very hot topic. And the vlogosphere is exploding. It's been exploding, and it has developed extremely dynamic modes of intertextuality or intervisuality, where people make a vlog and someone else makes a vlog in response to the vlog and someone quotes the vlog, and there's these kinds of circulations. But that kind of dynamic use of video is not really emerging so much yet in academia, it seems to me, although it's starting in a number of different fields, and they hope that this journal will be a space to hold that some of those new possibilities. So let me finish. What is our responsibility? Is something I wanted to touch on, because I think that particularly now I'm feeling very much that although it's essential to underscore the purely epistemic dimension of embodied practice, I personally cannot really stop there anymore, because the politics of it are also palpably urgent, increasingly palpably urgent. So in thinking about how to think about the politics of embodied knowledge and the politics of video epistemology of embodied practice, how to think about those politics without reducing the deep epistemic dimension of the practice. I'll mention two things and then I'll finish. One is the epistemological diversity of the space that can be created through this journal. And I won't even attempt to say, list in any kind of way what that epistemological diversity could include. I think it's clear in the description of the journal that there's a kind of disciplinary mapping of fields that have been engaged with embodiment, which is all over the humanities and all over the social sciences. It includes clearly the performance fields and theater and dance, but it also clearly includes the crucial work on embodiment that's been done in gender studies and queer studies and critical race studies, in indigenous studies, and all of those are linked to embodied practices, which means they're also linked to embodied knowledge. And so some of the responsibility, I think, is to really think, what does epistemological diversity mean, and how do we really mobilize new communities and new constituencies around that? And then the other thing that I'll mention is something about the way that the authorship is configured, which also includes the practices of citation in the videos. Practices of citation is a concept from Sarah Ahmed, but it has to do with the politics of the citation. And I've already been speaking with some people about possible submissions and thinking about what will be the authorship structure. Because one of the key elements in the speculative submission guidelines is that embodied practitioners whose work is documented in the video articles should be understood as authors. What does that mean? It's a big question, but it certainly is a change from the traditional modes of theater scholarship, performance scholarship, anthropology, in terms of what's the relationship to the embodied practitioner. If we understand the embodied practitioner as absolutely central to the research itself and not just the object of the research, that's going to change the structure of authorship and the structure of citation in ways that we can't predict. So all of these are questions which the journal is then an open field to really be hashed out through back and forth and through peer review, which I think is the crucial interdisciplinary peer review is a really exciting place to hash out these questions. So with that in mind, I've invited two of the editorial advisory board members who are coming from very different perspectives, also from me and from each other, to talk a little bit about their hopes and thoughts about the journal. First will be Rayana Vitra and then Paul Bowman.
Thank you, Ben. I just want to start by saying that I think it's absolutely crucial and timely that such a platform for scholarly work has been created. So, you know, well done, Ben, for getting us here. But I'm actually really honored to have been asked to join the advisory board as well, so thank you for that. And so when Ben asked me to become part of this really exciting platform in the capacity of an advisory board member, what was most exciting about it is the idea that these are going to be video essays, the video submissions. And that for two reasons, really, that struck me as really important and exciting. Number one, because as an Indian dance scholar with a history of knowing how, within my cultural context, knowledge has been passed on through generations, through oral traditions, and through embodied means, the need to write down what that knowledge is in order to validate it has always been something that I've struggled with. And from my perspective, it's been a colonizing Western sort of perspective on knowledge transmission. So this opportunity really opens up the possibility of decolonizing that trajectory. But with that comes a kind of democratization of who speaks and how they speak, and a level of openness about the possibilities that this medium offers. And what I mean by that is, so with another hat on as a co-editor for the training ground section for the Theatre, Dance and Performance Training Journal, which is specifically designed for engaging practitioner voices within an academic journal, I often come across practitioners, no matter how much we say to them that, you know, we want writing in different modalities, we want voices to be creative, and they still are restrained by the fact that they're having to write. That somehow, that in itself becomes a limiting factor for how they can articulate. So I think this offers a real kind of democratic process of who speaks, how they speak, what medium they speak in. And for me, for many different reasons, that may be where I am in my kind of scholarship as a South Asian dance scholar in this country. This, the idea of that democracy and the decolonizing factors are really important. Now, as a dance scholar, embodied research is not new. It's what we do. It's, you know, it is knowledge is made within us, and we study that knowledge that is made within us. But I still want to, on the advisory board, offer the possibility of maybe thinking about embodied research in a different way. And for this, I think my positionality as a brown Indian scholar within the UK context is vital. So I just want to sort of reflect on that for a second. To me, embodied research is driven by minoritarian embodied realities, which become both the source and the subject of dance scholarship. And I don't think I'm alone in thinking this way. Dance scholar Melissa Blanco Borelli echoes this very thought in her book, She is Cuba, A Genealogy of the Mulatta Body, and she says, ultimately, I quote, ultimately this is a project about the construction of subjectivity, the historical mulatta and my own, end quote. So Borelli's recognition of this collapse between the self and scholarly subject matter is very much the starting point of my own embodied dance scholarship. And this lends us, embodied scholars, an insider-outsider lens through which we can engage with the subject of what we write about. But there's something more than that. I think for the longest time, minority realities and voices have been written about by others. And what I look at through the possibility of this medium is a way of writing ourselves. And that excites me, and I think it's also a timely moment. So for example, when I was writing my book on Akram Khan, the British Asian dancer choreographer, one of the things that I was certain about that was going to make my contribution different to how other scholars had already written about him, although mine is the first monograph on it, on the artist, was the embodied position from which I could talk about his work. We're both British Bengali first and second generation subjects. We both trained in Kathak and then went on to train in contemporary dance forms. We're both in interracial marriages. We both have multicultural and mixed race children with mixed race heritages and multicultural heritages. And these are not simple, superficial facts that kind of bind us together, but it lent me a way of seeing his art that perhaps was not visible, that perhaps was not palpable to people coming at it from completely from the outside. So like Borelli, I made this self-investment very clear in the preface to my book, and I laid out the overlapping embodied realities between us. So my positionality vis-à-vis Khan's art making is vital to the ways in which I've been able to theorize his work. So, as an advisory board member for this journal, I'm committed to expanding our understanding of therefore what embodied research could mean. Of course it means practice-driven work, which we've all been celebrating and championing for such a long time within performance studies, where research questions are worked through embodied means. But I also want it to mean more complex modes of inquiry, where the relationship between the inquirer and the inquiry merges, such that the scholarship can emerge from the very tensions which are generated at the interstices between being an outsider and an insider to the subject of study. And then when you throw into the mix the modalities of what this digital platform can offer to these inquiries, the possibilities are endless, mind-boggling, still to be discovered, and frankly, game-changing. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. My name is Paul Bowman. I'm delighted to be involved. Thank you to Ben. And I've been asking myself why it would be me who would be involved, because I come from a very text-based, very logocentric world, English literature, visual cultural studies, political theory. But recently I've been involved in the development of what we're now calling martial arts studies. And martial arts studies has a peculiar problem with texts, with the written text, because the written text always seems to call out for more. So if you're doing historical martial arts studies, you look at the historical texts. And that text seems to demand the production or the generation of some kind of embodied knowledge. So literary texts, logocentric texts, lack something, and what they lack is the body. And there have been lots of different attempts to kind of generate this knowledge. There's a movement called Historical European Martial Arts, or HEMA, right? And in HEMA, it's kind of like a battle reconstruction, where they'll have these really ancient documents, and they try to embody it, and it's really riven with problems, but extremely interesting. And there's lots of different texts that structure the field of martial arts research, and they're all kind of different. So you go from the historical training manual, the historical Chinese training manual, and try to imagine what that martial art would have looked like, through to really bizarre texts like films. And nowadays, as Ben began by talking about Marcel Mauss and the transmission of ways of walking through films, films also transmit what people believe fights are like. So in the 70s, we started to believe that fights involved huge high kicks and so on. And subsequently, we believe they involved grappling and sometimes all different things. So even the most kind of hyper-real, what Baudrillard would call hyper-real, you know, the hyper-real martial arts cinema, the Bourne identity, the James Bond, these have real effects in the real world on people's bodies. And I also think it's particularly interesting, the thing that really interested me about what the first conversation that Ben and I ever had via Skype was about the production of invention of ways to learn and study embodied knowledge and embodied skill. And it's interesting that what the proposal is that it's through the video, that it's through the visual media, because then you're at this you know, Baudrillard thought we were losing the real through audiovisual media. What Ben is proposing, what we're all working on here is the kind of having a new relationship with real, mediate through films. So I think that's really important. I don't know a huge amount about this, but you know, I feel like a child, like a kid in a candy shop, you know, to be invited into this world and to help work this out. And I think that one of the very interesting things about this is the way that there's a kind of catch-up going on here, because the academic world is still very sort of logocentric, you know. Peer-reviewed, rigorous, scholarly work has to be words or algebra, right? It has to be written down, and that is it. We're existing now in this kind of state of denial in relation to what is very obviously a post-literate world that we live in. You know, my children can't spell, but they can make their own music videos, right? So that's the world that we live in. It's post-literate. And also, the things that we do on a day-to-day basis, everyone knows, if I do a lecture, my aspiration for the lecture is that it would be as good as a documentary. You know, so we use Prezi and we show video clips and everything, because the academic world has been kind of been hegemonized, been supplanted by audiovisual technology. And also my students, they want me to video the lecture as well. They'll turn off, which is nice. But then they also want to watch it again, because that's somehow more real than the real. Oh God, I am Baudrillard. So you know, audiovisual has, in most contexts, displaced the hegemony of the written word. So I think that one day we're going to see the video journal or something like it as the norm. But even if this happens, it doesn't diminish the kind of unique work of the Journal of Embodied Research that is yet to happen, really. Because I think that it's blazing a trail in general. It's posing these problems and proposing new ways of exploring and learning and then teaching from that and legitimating different types of knowledge. And it's engaging with these lots of problematics of how do you capture, how do you communicate, how do you validate, how do you legitimate things. So I think that a very great deal of journals that come after will be indebted to the Journal of Embodied Research. So I'm completely honoured and delighted to be part of this. And I will, much as I am, you know, a child in these waters, I'll do my best to try and help to flesh out the parameters of this new field. And also, you know, working out ways to help us legitimate this and to develop this. So thank you, Ben. Thank you, everyone.